This is a serious message to everybody watching my update right now. Peace and love, peace and love. I want to tell you, please, after the 20th of October, do not send fan mail to any address that you have. Nothing will be signed after the 20th of October. If that has a date on the envelope, it's going to be tossed. I'm warning you with peace and love, but I have too much to do. So no more fan mail. Thank you, thank you. And no objects to be signed. Nothing. Anyway, peace and love, peace and love.
From the struggling studios in Buffalo, New York, it's the Struggle is Real Buffalo Music Podcast. We know why the sound man has had a cold for 3 years.
Welcome. My name is Ryan Gurnett, and I have a hole in my butt.
My name's Dennis Reed, and I do too. That doesn't seem that odd. Please explain.
Welcome to The Struggle is Real. I had a cyst removed last Wednesday.
Yeah, actually, and I did know this because I saw you hobbling around band practice.
And basically, it's a series of ingrown hairs, is what a cyst is, that forms kind of a little pod
in the vagina.
And, you know, or under the nutsack, typically, or in my case, tailbone.
Labia.
So, the way they get rid of this hole in my butt, technically, is to then dig a bigger hole in my butt.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just leave it.
The bigger hole approach.
There's a giant, like, I've had to put packing gauze in this hole in my butt.
But it gets rid of the ingrown hair infection, right?
It does. It just seems kind of counterproductive that if you want to remove a hole, you dig a bigger hole.
Yeah, they can't mend the... They're just like, we got to start from a clean slate. Let's get some new skin cells in here.
And
it's over.
And if you have any questions about my cyst, you can ask us on our Twitter page. And the Twitter page is SIR Podcast.
NY?
NY.
Right?
Yes. So SIR for Struggles Real Podcast,
yep.
And then NY for New York.
Yeah, maybe we'll put up some pictures of the cyst.
I have a picture.
Is it really gross?
It might violate the terms of Twitter.
Oh, yeah, okay. Fair enough. So we got a cool show today. This one's been in the can for a while. We're about to hear an interview that we recorded back in, I believe, June 21st.
Oh.
We recorded this interview. And why don't you tell us about our guest today?
We're going to have Charles Quagliana. He is the man behind...
the mastermind.
Local prog rockers, the Left Hand of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the grumpy sound guy from Good Bar.
That's right.
And we're going to learn a lot from him in this episode. We are going to learn about the helmet and how you can use it to terrorize people just wanting to walk around Buffalo in the summer.
We'll find out how Charles's gig with Dan Harper and the Magic Show disappeared into thin air.
We are going to learn about how many pedals is too many pedals. Or in Charles's case, there's no such thing as too many pedals.
That's right. And we're also going to learn how Charles's bandmate and Buffalo legend, the late Ted Reinhardt, got Charles back into music with In the Left Hand of Darkness. Okay, so a pretty long one, too. I think Charles was really generous and sat down with us for a long time and had a lot of really interesting things to say about the scene, so please stick around for those. All right, hi, welcome to the Struggle is Real Buffalo Music Podcast. I'm Dennis Reed.
I am Ryan Gurnett.
And we are here in the studio, in the Highgate Avenue studio, with Charles Quagliana, who is from The Left Hand of Darkness, is his musical act, and he's also, you might have seen him on the scene, he is a sound guy at Mr. Good Bar, and also a gear enthusiast, a tech fanatic. We're going to talk to him about all these things today, so welcome, Charles.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for coming and making the time. So, start with the way a lot of people might know you. We've worked with you before at Mr. Good Bar. Are you still running sound at Mr. Good Bar?
On and off. I actually trained another guy, and his name's TJ, and I got another guy, his name's Mike France, another gentleman my age, and he's like filling in some of the odd dates, because I've decided I was going to put more effort into my repair business, and so I've been doing less sound.
You're like consciously trying to get out of the sound guy gig a little bit?
You know, I've tried. Like, I went back to school and just spent, like, almost $4,000 to get recertified as a machinist, but...
I think I know the answer to this question, but does it suck being a sound guy?
Sometimes it sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty kickback gig for the most part.
Yeah, because it seems like, you know, it's... all the standing around in a bar and none of the jamming or fun like that I get to have as a musician.
And I'm a musician too,
and I like to have
fun. I like playing. And actually at one point I was like, I'm not going to do sound anymore. I'm going to join a band or two and I'm just going to play music. And about a year or two of that, and I was like, wow, this is a lot of work for pretty much for no money.
Right.
I was doing, I played with... Dan Harper and the Magic Show.
I'm familiar, actually.
For, God, was it a year? It was almost 2 years.
Oh, cool.
And we'd have, like, a weekly gig. We had the last one that I remember was, I think it was the last one before I got fired, was at the Mixology. And I think about a month after I got fired from the band.
Oh, you got fired from that gig?
Yeah. You know,
what happened?
I have a little bit of an attitude.
Oh, no.
So, and I don't know, they just kept, they had, the way they had the band set up in there, it was by the front door. So we were like the, you know, we were doing, what do you call it, like a
like
happy
no
hour.
Stage or anything, you're just
no,
kind of crammed wherever.
No, and the people are coming, and so I'm all the way to the left by the front door with an upright bass in a doorway, the one doorway in and out of the building. Well, I had a side door, but people weren't coming in through that door. They were coming in through the front. So it just got to be, they decided, oh, we want this area where we were before, which was kind of in the back corner, and it was perfect. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't good enough for them. They had to change it. And I wound up standing by the door, and it was really frustrating for me. And one night, I just was like, I'd had enough of it. And I was like, you know, well, pretty soon I'm going to be in the closet with the ATM playing upright bass. And I was like, so anyways, I guess, you know.
You felt like the guy from...
Dan Harper had enough of me, so
yeah.
That was it.
Were like people bumping into you or like spilling drinks on you at all when you're...
No, it was there's just having to move out of the way. Like, okay. I couldn't just play...
Right.
I had to always be watching for people.
So your closet.
So the door's going to bump into
me. And, you know, drunk people in a bar, and pretty soon people are bumping into me. You know, they were bumping into me with the bass.
Right, right.
And so it was like, okay, great.
Yeah, and then you can't feel free and move and anything. You're just sort of, I'd imagine that's stressful.
Yeah, it's hard getting into the music.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I had pretty much fun. I've mainly joined that band. My cousin, John Quagliana, played drums in that band.
And, oh, okay.
And it was funny, kind of a funny story. I was doing a show at Club Diablo, and they were doing, again, one of these happy hour gigs, and I'm like, wow, they don't have a bass player. And I say, hey, it's my cousin John. So I walk in between sets, I go talk to him, and I'm like, yeah, you guys looking for a bass player? I'm like, yeah, after you guys are done, I was doing a show. Actually, it was a pretty amazing show. One of the, like, my first show at Diablo was an awesome show. I did it with Cosmic Shakedown and the Old Pound, and it was like the first time I ever had money like for a show that I did, like the guy hands me the door money and it was like $450. I was like, whoa,
I'm rich.
And I was like, oh, I can pay Ted. And not out of my pocket. And I was like, well, obviously that Cosmic Shakedown and Wool Pound brought most of the people. So I basically did like, you guys split the $300. And then, did Pam play at that? And I don't think she played at that gig. But anyways, I like took the $300. They gave him $150 apiece. And I split the rest of the money, which was, I gave Ted, I think, $80, which left me with, like, enough to pay my bar tab. So I was pretty happy.
Yeah, excellent. That is a successful night,
that,
I think.
Oh, that's always my approach to shows. It's like,
and I didn't get a parking ticket, and yeah. I made it home.
Right.
Without incident.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was a great show. And that was, it was like some guy that I had hardly met, Jesse Zufle, who used to run the Club Diablo. Oh, sure, I'll let you do a Friday night. I was like, all right.
Ooh. So who else are you doing any playing right now? It looks like your current project is Left Hand of Darkness.
Yeah, which I do like some gigs solo, but I actually formed another band with Jeff Janikowski on drums, and he plays in an Irish band called, I want to say it's This Old Goat.
I was in a band with Jeff Janikowski for like 3 or 4 years, just a few years back, called Nimble Vagrant. He's amazing.
Yeah, he's I want to play this prog rock music. He's like, because he goes, we started talking about all the shows that we went to, and like going to see the Stickmen and Security Project, and I'm going to see King Crimson at the end of the month here in Rochester. And I'm like, man, we go to the same shows. And the way we met was he heard my music online, and he actually came by my house to pick up a hard copy CD. And he's like, yeah, I really would be interested, because this was probably about maybe 6 to 8 months after Ted died.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Reinhardt. Yeah. And I was like, I mean, I don't know if I really would have started playing music again if it wasn't for Ted. I mean,
no kidding.
And I loved getting together with Ted, you know.
What did you play with? What was that band that you played
with?
That
was the Left Hand of Darkness. I made an album with Ted.
Oh, okay.
That Dancing Ant song, that's Ted
Reinhardt.
No kidding. Wow. We co-wrote those. Every song on the record was co-written with Ted. With the exception of Relentless, that's one of Ted's songs, and I wanted him to do it, and one day I came into the studio, and he'd already been working on it for like 2 or 3 hours, and I was like, oh, that's, because it was a really interesting thing, and he's the only other person that really played the stick. Like, he used to play the stick like on his lap, sitting down. And
play the what do you mean play the stick?
The Chapman stick?
Oh, but
finger tapping instrument.
Oh.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
That's the thing. I mean, that's what I play. I've been playing that instrument on and off for over 20 years, 25 years now.
Interesting. It's called the stick?
The stick, and the guitars I have now are called the crappy touch style guitars, which essentially the tuning is the same as the original Chapman stick. Now everything is kind of spread out. Different people use different tunings. But the original Chapman stick from back in the 80s, Tony Levin,
interesting,
was the main proprietor of the Chapman stick with Peter Gabriel. Also, on John Lennon's Double Fantasy, there's Chapman stick, Tony Levin playing the stick on that album.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember what the name of the song was. But.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. Oh, okay, yeah, Ryan's showing me a picture here on his phone.
I have tons of pictures.
And it just looks like a fretboard, kind of, and almost like a...
It's a neck.
Yeah, like the neck of a guitar.
The crappy looks more like a guitar, but the neck is wide.
It's, yeah, it looks like a...
The narrow one, the 10 strings, it's...
Oh, it's 10, okay.
At the very widest spot on a 6-string bass is about the whole width. Like, there's no taper in it. It's straight.
So, Ted Reinhardt, you were talking about, he, of course, was a Buffalo music legend. I believe he played with Gamelon, right?
Yeah.
And probably a lot of other groups. What made him, and we lost him recently, what made him so special to play with?
He's the best one of the best drummers I've ever played with. A great musician, super creative, very into improvisational music. Like, just, you know, basically, let's just puff one and start playing some music without a lot of, you know, deliberation. Yeah. I mean, we practiced a lot, especially before the studio, but a lot of what we did was just pure improvisation. We just take a little theme and run with it.
Yeah.
Used to have, like, kind of, I don't know, it just seemed like a window between 7 to 10 minutes to develop, like, these looping patterns, and just the way he would just churn out all these, I mean, just these amazing rhythm. He can make, like, amazing rhythm patterns on just about anything. Like, if you just gave him a piece of wood to hit.
Sure.
With his drumsticks, and we played some gigs where he didn't use a regular drum kit. He would just bring, like, a keyboard stand and put a piece of wood on it with a piece of carpet, and he would stack stuff on it, and then he had, like, another little stand with some bongos, and he'd have a couple of weird things hooked up to foot pedals, but not like a snare drum and a regular trap kit. And the second time we went into the studio, he's like, oh, I got an idea of some, I'm going to build this kit, and we're going to, like, I was like, yeah, we should just go in the studio and try to do some improv stuff. And I think we got about 4 songs out of a weekend's worth of stuff, plus I have easy about 2.5-3 hours of him just playing the drums, just jamming away on all these crazy rhythms.
Cool. Well, speaking of albums, if we can still call them that, we're going to listen to your track now from The Left Hand of Darkness. And do you want to tell us a little bit about this track that we're about to hear, of the name of it, where to come from, who plays on it, anything you want to say?
This song, The Dancing Ants, was written by me and Ted Reinhardt, and the main riff is in 37/16, and it wasn't like a deliberate thing. It was just the way that I came up with this idea, and Ted's like, oh, this doesn't sound right. And then we tried it the 36/16 way, and it really didn't sound right. and he says, I'm going to figure this out. And we figured it out, and the rest is history.
whoa, stop the interview.
Well, it was going great. What?
I have something I want to talk about, Dennis.
All right.
There are some great local shows going on in the next month.
Oh, we love local shows. Love to go out and
support.
And
on December 20th, Funkworthy, Tiger Chung Lee, and Acid Cats are playing at Mohawk Place.
Oh, nice.
Funkworthy, obviously a funk band. I checked them out. They're pretty good. I was blown. They're called Tiger Chung Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And from the photos, it looks like they're like a 14-piece funk and soul band.
Wow.
And they sound incredible. Like, I was... It's one of those things where you hear a local band that sounds like that, and it's like, how did I not know about this? How does everyone not know about this? They're spectacular. So I wanted to let everyone know about that. Also, there is a cool kind of indie rock band called Johnny and the Man Kids, and they are also playing at Mohawk Place on December 27th. And then if you are looking for some non-local entertainment, the Sam Roberts Band. Have you ever heard Sam Roberts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I had not. I knew he was a big in Canada, but yep. I didn't really know anything about him. He's playing at Town Ballroom on December 30th. I am hoping I can get in there to do a review of it, because everything I heard of him just sounds great.
Yeah, Sam, he's a solid songwriter, great performer. Actually, 4'10".
No shit, really?
4'10". Not really, but he's pretty small. He's pretty small.
He got me excited.
When he walks up to you, yeah, you wouldn't tower over him, but you're about the same height.
Aww.
Yeah, okay. I have like a quarter of an inch on you, but I'm gonna crack tall jokes.
You do better. Take every advantage you can get.
So other cool shows coming up include this up and coming
juggernaut,
fierce little juggernauts, irrepressible up and coming jangle rock group called The Lady or the Tiger.
I completely forgot to talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. We are going to be playing on the 22nd at Stamps on Main Street in Tonawanda.
Yes.
So it's like our fourth time there, or is it our third time there?
I even thought it might have been more than four.
Really?
We've played there quite a few times.
Oh, well, we're looking forward to that, and there's other cool groups on the bill, so please come out and check that out and support us and the other musicians.
I know Billy Draws 2 is on the bill,
mm-hmm.
and we've played with them before. They put on a really good live show.
Yep. Absolutely. So, and then I'm going to be with my Neil Young cover band December 30th. At the Sportsman's Tavern, the wonderful Sportsman's Tavern. Right now, it says on Facebook that it's a 3:30 showtime, but I doubt that's true. So come check out some Neil Young stuff, and let's get back to the interview.
Hey, on the 30th, you can check out Zuma at, where was it again?
The Sportsman's Tavern.
You can check them out at Sportsman's Tavern, and then have just enough time to get to the town ballroom to go to the Sam Roberts Band, and you can pull a rock and roll doubleheader. You don't get that many opportunities to do something like that.
Do something with your life, people.
Yes! Hi, this is Ryan Gurnett, and I'm here with my co-host, Dennis Reed Jr.
Trusty co-host.
That's a stretch. And we're here to tell you the struggle is real, and we're here with Charles Quagliana of The Left Hand of Darkness, and you may know him from doing sound at Mr. Goodbar and Sound Lab and a lot of other ones in the area. And, you were just telling us about just this crazy guitar rig you have. Do you want to, like, suck up three full pedal boards?
There are three full pedal boards, and the crappy touch style and the stick, they're both stereo instruments. There's a bass side and a guitar side to simplify it. So there's two signal paths going. One side goes into a guitar amp, and one side goes into a bass amp. So there's not, it's just, like with a guitar, I've seen people with ridiculous guitar pedal boards, but I have two signal paths. So the way I had set it up is I've got like what I call like the core, which is the main board. Like if I had to play with one pedal board, I would just bring the one, and it's got a volume pedal for each side, and then I have like the guitar preamp, and I use the Yamaha DG Stomp, which is kind of a funky old thing, but they're cheap. Like I think I have one, my main one, I think I paid like $80 for it, and I have a backup for that, because I'm pretty dependent on it. And it's got, basically I just use that as like clean overdrive distortion. It's got three buttons on it. I think it has a fourth button. I don't ever really use it for much. But it gives me like my basic tones. It has some built-in effects, but I don't use them. I use pedals for the other effects, and then I run it out of that into a Yamaha Magic Stomp, and which I use for delays and pitch shifting, and then I go into a this is the guitar side still. And then I run from there into a Line 6 M9, which I use for more delay. I can select also a phase shifter or a flanger. And these are all like post-delay or post-pitch shifter. And then it runs from there into the Line 6 DL4, which is a delay. But I almost exclusively use that as a looper because it has reverse and half speed, and it's pretty intuitive to use in a live situation. What else? At the beginning, and then I have like another external pedal board, which has another distortion on it. I use this, it's a MXR full bore metal, which is kind of a crazy distortion. It's really saturated, and it has a built-in noise gate. To me, it almost sounds more like a really heavy fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
And then going back to the beginning in the first pedal board, I have Electro-Harmonix Microsynth.
Ooh, that's a nice pedal.
And then it goes from there into a Digitech Whammy 4, which I have hooked up to a MIDI pedal that lets you select the patches on it, which the way I have it set up, it goes slow chorus, fast chorus, up an octave, down an octave, up two octaves. And while you're playing, you can actually switch between all those sounds. And
with your foot.
Yeah, without stopping playing. You don't have to reach down and tweak anything. And
right.
That makes for some weirdness. Really haven't been using that much lately. But when I do my solo thing, I like to have all the pedal boards, because then I just don't run out of sounds.
Right.
When I'm looping, because the looping is, you know, it's repetitive, and I try to vary it by varying the tones that I put over the loops.
Now, do you get out and play around town with this, or is this more something you're working on?
Oh, no, every year I do stuff for the Infringement Festival at the minimum.
Oh, cool.
And,
yeah, Dennis, the Infringement Festival.
I know, that I haven't playing booked this for.
Because
know.
It's great.
Mm-hmm.
And I play, like, mostly, during Infringement, I do most of my playing in, like, art galleries and non-standard venues. Sometimes I play outside. I have this other rig, which is it's a battery-powered setup where I don't have to plug into anything. Mm-hmm. I've got, like, a belt pack that has I have a couple of effects pedals on that, and a little portable two-channel amplifier, which connects up to I have this helmet that has two speakers on top, one for the bass and one for the guitar.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No. I just did a...
That's fucking awesome.
I just did a thing at the Allentown Art Festival. I played at the very end of Allen Street, and I looked up when I was playing, and I was like, oh, there's like... This is a great gig, because there's like 20 or 30 people just standing there going, what? And then there's usually the, did you make that? What instrument is that? Is that a sitar?
Yeah.
And that rig I came up with, it's too bad. It's just the easiest way to explain it is, like, the whole thing is I can walk around. Like,
yeah, you're like a mobile unit, battery powered.
And I did this, originally I did it because they had this, Infringement, like, promotional thing, and they're like, you can't use amplifier. And I was like, well, what can I do? And at the time, I had these two separate little battery-powered amplifiers that had the speakers built in, but I'm like, where? I can't mount those, you know, like I'd have all these cables coming down from my head. So somehow the idea with the helmet, with there's like a bar that goes across the top, and the two speakers are, they're just the speakers. There's no cabinet or, you know, they're just hanging from the top of this bar. It's kind of, it's très bizarre, no?
Is it a heavy helmet?
It's not that heavy. Like, I mean, I walk around, I'll play, basically, I think I can play for 2 or 3 hours before the batteries start to, in the amplifier. That's the one thing, is that the amplifier sucks the batteries down.
Oh, yeah.
So I can play for 2 or 3 hours continuous, and one time I really got to try it out was at this thing, they had this Trimania.
Yep.
Big, it was huge, there was thousands of people there in this huge building over off of Main Street, over by the train tracks.
Yeah, I guess it's the old Trico.
Yeah, and what I was doing was, I was walking around in the halls, and it was too noisy, and then I was like, oh, let's go back downstairs, I want to try playing in the elevator. So I just went up and down in the elevator for about 20 minutes, playing in the elevator, just standing in the back of the elevator. And then my original spot that I had stoked out was playing in the stairwell. And that was awesome because there was always a pretty... I found between like the second... the second and third floor, you were kind of far enough from the loud bands, but people were still moving around. So there's always a pretty steady stream of people coming through the stairwells to get... you know, either upstairs or go back downstairs where all the food and stuff was. And so the helmet amp, like, moved from just this wacky idea that just to solve a problem of, like, well, they're going to have a microphone, but my instrument doesn't really make much sound. Like, it's like an electric guitar. Doesn't make much sound if it's not plugged into some kind of amp. But the question was how to, like, project that sound into a microphone, so I came up with that idea.
Wow. I'm sorry, I was just going to ask if there's any improvements planned to the helmet, or the amp helmet, what were we calling it?
Yeah, dude, I was going to ask, do you have like a nickname for it?
The Helmut amp, like H-E...
Oh, like much.
M-U with an umlaut. T, not helmet. Helmut.
Helmut.
And
can you get some Goldschlager or anything on there, or a beer, or
maybe an IKEA sponsorship?
The first year I played, I just like go at the closing ceremonies on Allen Street by Nietzsche's. It's like it's crazy there on that night. And I had my beers in a cooler in the back of my truck, and I was like probably wind up sleeping in my truck. But we were there for long enough, and. It didn't really matter, but walking around, like, just jamming with different musicians, people playing percussion and, you know, wind instruments, most stuff that's mostly acoustic.
Right.
But that was, like, so what the next phase of the helmet amp was to upgrade the amplifiers, and so a friend of mine got this little tiny circuit board. It's, like... probably about an inch square, and I think the original purpose of it was like as an iPod amplifier, like so you could just hook it up to any speakers.
Right.
But so I went from like 3.5 watts a side up to like 15 a side, so I could actually get a good clean sound. Before, like with the old amplifiers, it was like distortion or almost no volume, and you had to turn the volumes down on the instrument to get like just a little bit of a clean sound, and it was still kind of jagged. But the new amplifier actually gets a good clean sound, so I can like play actual music on it rather than, because the original thing was I'm just like, well, all I've got is a distortion sound. I'm just going to do all this. I just was like, I'm going to see how many notes I could play in 1 minute. And I don't know how many it was, but it was a real lot.
There's got to be a Guinness Book of like world record for that, you think?
They have a speed thing. Like, you know, like they have a thing on for the fastest double bass drum, which mm-hmm. is like 1,000 beats per minute. So it's like insane.
Yeah.
It's like... They're like...
So did you, walking around and doing this sort of mobile helmet, did you meet any people, like any other artists who wanted to, you know, collaborate with you? Or did that lead to any other sort of performance art or musical projects?
Mm.
Anybody ask you, like, hey, I need the helmet in my, you know, interpretive dance?
No, you know, it didn't really happen. One of the more interesting things was the Buffalo PD. Like, go, hey, come here.
They wanted to collaborate?
They said, here, play a song for us. And so I played Smoke on the Water. I was like, well, they're not going to recognize this crazy music that I normally play.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I could play that riff pretty solid. So I did that, and I got a thumbs up from...
Oh, that's great.
From the... They were like, wow, that's really cool.
They didn't accuse you of violating any...
And actually, I was, like, getting ready to pull some beer out of the back of my truck,
uh-oh.
Too. So I... Luckily, I escaped from that situation.
So you also repair equipment. Seems like you've been, you said you've been trying to get, is it just your name? Do you have like a business name at all that you're going under or anything like that?
Cubetronics.
All right.
And I do repairs for Allentown Music.
Okay.
Some stuff for Guitar Factory. And then the rest of it is just people that know me.
If you want to pitch your phone number to people for repairs, you're free to. Or an email address or something? No.
No.
Okay. Do you want everyone on the internet to have your personal information? Really?
Just find them a good.
But so, like, you've been probably repairing stuff for a long time. It sounds like you.
I've been doing repairs since 1988, 89, somewhere right in there, over 25 years.
What is like the most like fucked-est piece of equipment you ever seen? Like, what's the worst treated? Like, I had an old Marshall amp that used to like start on fire when you started it up. What's like the worst, most beat up piece of equipment someone's given to you to repair? Like,
I've seen, like you got your assortment of, you know, like dead insects and spider webs and, you know, cockroaches, you know. The insects will like crawl across the like high voltage rails and burn up and you know make like a burn mark on the circuit board. I got this one keyboard that synthesizer that I'm working on for a guy. It's I don't know if it might be beyond help. He has kids and they spilled stuff in it.
Oh.
And he didn't like clean it out. It just sat in there, so it corroded stuff. And he's like, well, you know, I turned it on one time and it, like now it just goes beep and the one little red line shows up in the display. It doesn't make any sound. And it had some blown fuses in it and it's not very easy to work on. Like the power supply is in a spot where it's difficult to measure stuff when it's turned on. And it's like, it's just... And it's not a common one. I've never actually worked on one before. It's not like a Roland or a Korg or, you know.
Have you ever opened up for any, like, big national touring acts?
And if so, were they major assholes? And name names, tell us all about it.
You don't have to name names if you don't want to.
Well,
but if you
major.
Do, that's better.
Yeah.
I guess I opened up one time in San Francisco for Elliot Sharp. But you know, he's like an avant-garde guitarist from New York City.
Okay.
And it really wasn't a big deal. Like, my band actually opened up for him when I used to have with a drummer and a violinist. And
and
then he
fan?
Does a thing, like a solo thing. And I just, it's so vague because it was... 20 years ago. I don't really remember it. And I'm friends with him on Facebook.
Oh, cool.
And yeah. So, but he played here, he just played here within the last couple of years over at Hallwalls. And I remember vaguely, someone was like, do you know where I could get a deluxe reverb, a blackface one? I was like, no. Well, I'm not I don't even take my own out to gigs, so
yeah.
I'm not gonna rent it to anybody.
Right.
And there was this other band also at the DNA. Once in a while I used to like consult with the headlining bands to see if I could kind of squeak myself in at the DNA because I worked there and they had a backline already there. Like, there was a bass amp, and my violinist always used to bring his setup, but I knew I had a bass amp and a guitar amp that were there, so I just, that would be one of those. Then this is pre-looping era as well, so this band called Boiled in Lead, they're like a Celtic fusion band.
Okay.
And again, this was a long time ago, but they're really Irish sounding. Like, they take... like traditional Irish music and kind of rock it up a little bit.
Okay.
And add in like a little fusion element as well.
Check that out. That actually does sound really interesting.
Yeah. It's just from this would probably be about 1996, 97, somewhere in there.
That's right. It's all on Spotify.
Oh, I'm going to look for it. So, how about doing sound? I'm sure you've had some bigger name acts that you've done sound for. Anyone in particular? Anyone like just do something really weird? Where the you know I've had people. I had a guitar player in my one band. He had a power sander where the part of the engine didn't work, but he would still hold the power sander up, rev the engine, but the thing wouldn't run, so his pickups would feed back into it. Any just insanity like that that you saw while you're doing sound?
I'm Facebook friends with this guy. His name's Jinmo Avantatak, and he plays his guitar with samurai swords.
Wow.
And he does this... He does like a, what I would call like a very non-traditional guitar style. Like he can play classical music and stuff on his guitar, but he mostly chooses not to do that. And he does a lot of stuff with looping and effects. And he'll do play the guitar more like a percussion instrument, where he's picking really fast and just flopping his fingers on the neck like percussively. But it just sounds kind of like kind of a lot of notes. And then he does the thing with the samurai swords where he has, you know, a short one and a long one, and he puts the short one, like, under the strings and uses the long one kind of like a bow. That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah. What kind of, does it make like a saw sound or like more like an ebo almost?
when you take a round... Like a screwdriver, I've actually got what I found works. I have some machine tools, like they're reamers and drill bits. You don't want to use the sharp edge on the string. Use the smooth part. And like a screwdriver is a really long screwdriver, like about a foot long, is a perfect thing. And when you like just lay it on the string and just like move it slightly back and forth, it just starts going... And... You know, you can put it on one string, use your other hand to mute strings, let other strings ring. You don't have to use it like a bow. You just start it moving. I actually take two chrome slides, and I play the stick with the slides like that on both sets of strings, usually with like a lot of delay. And the distortion gives it more, makes it more sensitive because it's kind of a light sound.
Mm-hmm.
And what other weird stuff have I... one time we set up a grand piano on a stage, and the dude who was playing it threw ping pong balls inside it.
Oh, wow, like one of those like treated
and
pianos.
And it was hard, very difficult to get a grand piano up onto like a 4-foot-high stage. We did this weird thing with these wooden blocks, and somehow we got it up there. And then the tuner came in and tuned it, and the guy threw ping pong balls on it. And what else did he put?
I think I've seen something like that before.
Yeah, and he put like tin foil.
It was
on
like
the
John
strings.
Cage used to play, like
treated
piano. Yeah,
okay.
And put, it was very much. And we were just like, we just stood there and we were like, whoa. Well, they paid the bill, so it didn't matter. So,
right. So, you are a sound man. You got a lot of experience. Hopefully, some other local bands are going to be listening to this podcast. And as a sound man, is there anything you would like to tell local bands to start doing or stop doing to help a show go better?
Good question.
You know, like, what's your, I guess, peeve?
I think he has too many answers. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, there's, like, about fifth. Well, one thing, just right now, like, a lot of people have, like, these vocal processor effects that they use.
Mm-hmm.
I would kind of steer away from that.
What does that do? Why is that a bad thing?
Well, a lot of times, like, if you're putting delay and reverb and enhancer and crazy stuff like that into the monitors, it's very difficult. If you were the only band playing the show and you could take time to set it up properly, it wouldn't be so bad, but you know, you need time to do that.
Yeah.
And when you're
which you don't often have
when you're playing
on
a
local,
in a club, and you're better off not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Tune your guitars. Be another thing. And the stage at a club is not the time for rehearsal. The rehearsal right. time is on your own time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
That's good advice.
Those monitors sound awful bassy. Can you take some of the bass out of those?
Get a lot of that?
I'm quoting you.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I'm sure.
That's weird. You know, I finally went up there. Like, sometimes I forget, but, like, before I'm, like, going up on that stage, and I'm like, yeah, you've got three monitors. They're, like, about 300 watts a piece, so got some volume. And then you walk up on the stage and start talking into a mic, and you'd, like, stand in a certain spot and go, wow, you really can't hear anything standing right here.
Mm-hmm.
I do less of that. It's like, you know, when you're running monitors from the back, it's like, well, if they were all at the same height and the ceiling wasn't shaped weird and there wasn't a mirror behind you.
Right.
But, I mean, monitors seem like a afterthought in a lot of places. And, I mean, you know,
Which is too bad because they really, you know, I am a singer and boy, I need them. I mean, I don't think I'm excruciatingly exact, but I got to be able to hear myself. I have enough trouble staying on pitch.
You're excruciatingly exact.
One time I used to do monitors in like a big rehearsal studio for like Jefferson Starship, whatever bands came through the SIR San Francisco rehearsal studio, and there was an awful lot of them. And one of the bands that I used to do, the two that are sticking in my mind as particularly labor-intensive were when the Jefferson Starship would come in, because they wouldn't even, like, we'd have everything set up and all the monitors dialed before they even got there, and that, we would spend probably 3 hours on the Jefferson Airplane vocal monitors, mostly.
Now that is excruciatingly exact.
Yeah.
And the guy knew exactly what he wanted, and I'd just stand at the monitor board, and he'd say, take this out, put this in, him over there, me over here.
Right.
And with Frankie Beverly and Mays, the vocalist used to use this Neumann handheld condenser mic. I mean, this is like, back then it was like over $1,000 mic. And it sounded amazing, but it was super sensitive, and it would take at least an hour to get that thing dialed in just one mix, 1 hour on one mix, because it was just like, okay, and then we'd stop for a little bit and then listen to it again. And this is all before the band was even there. The room's empty. It's me and the tour manager and the band tech.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the band tech was me too. They actually wanted to hire me and take me out on the road, and I was like, "No, pass."
That one. You didn't want to do that every night of your life.
Great band, and it's just the other thing too is, you know, good sound equipment is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was looking at what the new Myers like line arrays cost now, and like, you go to a concert and you see like 16 of these boxes on either side, and they're right. like $3,000 a piece.
Wow.
And that doesn't even count the amplifiers and, you know, all that stuff. And I mean, like for me, like I go see a good venue, consistently good, is Rapids Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got, I want to say they still have the Yorkville line array. It's almost the same system that's at the ballroom, although the ballroom now has a Midas Pro Series digital board that they're using, whereas the Rapids still have their old school Yamaha digital boards, but the sound is always good at Rapids.
Who's got the best sounding room in Western New York, you think?
I think it's the Rapids.
Yeah.
I love that room. I hate it when you have to stand for 4 or 5 hours, but the sound there is always good. Except when Mastodon's playing there.
Uh-oh. That little dig?
I'm going to skip that part.
Sure. Very good. Any more questions?
I think I'm good.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Charles. This has been an illuminating conversation. We got to hear about what bothers a sound man. We got to hear about your helmet.
Yeah, it's hard for me to go to shows and just listen. It really takes a conscious effort.
You mean you're critiquing all the time?
Oh, it's almost impossible to go to a show and not go, what, you know, like, if you go to a show and there's no kick drum in the PA, it drives you nuts.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you're like, oh, I can't hear the singer, or, you know, where's the guitar? Or like, with Periphery, there's three guitar players, but the bass player is a recorded track, and you're like, God, I can't hear the bass. And you're like, oh, wait, there is no bass player.
Right.
He's coming off a recording, and they're playing the tracks for the whole show. Yeah.
So it's hard to take off the sound man's hat when you're out.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, sometimes, you know, I went to go see Steve Wilson at the ballroom, and where I was standing, all the way over on the left, right hand side, like, it's kind of under where the speakers are flown. You're never going to get like a great sound there, but the stage sound was really good, and they weren't all using in-ears. There was wedges on the stage, and plus the actual sound of the band, like the volume that they were playing at, you could really hear the band on the, coming off the stage, and the speaker's more like over your head, so you're not really getting blown out by right. the PA. You feel the bass,
mm-hmm.
but the stage sound was good. But I like to be able to see mm-hmm. at a show. I mean, if I want to hear the great sound, you know, you go home and listen to it, either put on some good headphones, or, you know, I could always put it on my studio monitors or something, which
right.
I don't really do much.
Right. Well, you know, I got one more question that reminds me. Is it true that the best place in a club to stand, if you want to hear the best sound, or I know a lot of people like try to tape at shows, is right in front of the mixing board?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I went to see Ozfest, and I saw Black Sabbath, and I sat right by the soundboard, and I was like, you got a guy who's been mixing sound for probably 30 or, I mean, been mixing the same band for 30 or 40 years, and it was like, you could hear, you know, giving kudos to some of the other sound guys in the other bands, but they sounded amazing.
Wow.
You could hear it. When you can hear the squeaking of the hi-hat, you can hear the hi-hat pedal sound
through
the PA.
Like the springs.
But, and everything.
Kick.
Like, you never had to strain to hear any, like, if you wanted to listen for a specific instrument, you never had to strain for it. You never had to strain to hear the bass. You could hear every time the lead came, you could always hear it perfectly. Not ear-piercingly loud, not buried. Everything was perfect, like, it seemed to me it was perfect the whole time.
Right, right. Oh, great. Okay, so there's a pro tip for you. Go by the sound man.
Yeah.
If you want to hear the best sound in a club.
And when we saw, when we were just at Rapids and we saw Gojira, like another case where the guy's been mixing the band for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around for over 20 years, so you'd think that they probably had the same guy. Like Metallica has the same guy. His name is Mick Hayes.
Yep.
And you pretty much, wherever they go, the sound is good or
right.
great. Even in big outside, not as difficult as like inside of like HSBC or like inside of an arena where there's just tons of reverb and.
Yeah.
Obviously, the sound's not going to be great up in the rafters, but maybe down on the lower levels, you could actually hear it.
Right, right. Well, thanks for being here again. And we've been talking with Charles Quagliana of the Left Hand of Darkness. Check him out. And we will see you next time on the Struggle Is Real Buffalo Music Podcast.
On all WNYnews.com. Dennis, wake up.
Hey, what's up?
The interview's over, and there's still people here.
Who? I don't see anybody.
Well, I think what we need to do is tell them about our graced hosts, allwnyradio.com. They probably want to know about our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thestruggleisrealpodcast. Don't forget about our Twitter, again, which is SIRpodcastNY. And I wanted to take some time and give another shout-out to Dustin Hummel, who
Announcer.
Yes, our announcer. He did a great job with that. He hosts his own podcast about terrible B-movies called Upchuck Theater. It is excellent. You should check it out.
Sort of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 idea?
Sort of, yeah.
Okay.
And is there anything else? Do we have anything else?
No, I got nothing else this episode.
All right. Here, Dennis, I'm going to give you back your blanket. You can rock right back asleep.
Yes. I get the door. I get the whole door.
They're so precious at this age.
He's not with me. I need the mic.